Coming up on this episode of the podcast Under the Stairs, we kick off a brand new subset of shows, the In Reverence series. This series will cover the movies that shaped my love of genre cinema. Every single movie is a five-star movie, and we'll be kicking it off with one of the most important films I ever saw. But first, it's year four, motherfuckers, and you know what that means? This time, it's war. Warning. The podcast Under the Stairs is not safe for work. We'll feature movie spoilers and language which most listeners may find offensive. Brought to you in conjunction with Legion Podcast Network. Welcome to the podcast Under the Stairs.
Our next movie is named Blue Velvet, and already this movie has caused a firestorm around the country, with some advance reviews calling it a masterpiece and others calling it sick and depraved, and still others calling it a sick, depraved masterpiece. Blue Velvet is a movie that really challenges you to think about your reactions to it, and my reaction is I think this movie is cruelly unfair to its actors. It was directed by David Lynch, the same man who made Eraserhead and Dune, and he's a talented director. You can see that here in scenes that have a lot of power. But he asks Isabella Rossellini in this movie to be undressed and humiliated on the screen, as few actresses ever have been, certainly in non-porno roles. And then he tries to take the edge off her shocking scenes by turning the whole thing into some kind of a joke. Well, either this material is funny, in which case you don't take advantage of your stars, or it isn't funny, in which case it shouldn't have so much campy and adolescent dialogue along with the really powerful sexual scenes. Sure, the movie's well made, but the more I thought about it, the less I liked it.
Well, I liked it, and I thought about it a lot, and I think you may be on the wrong tack in trying to feel sorry for Isabella Rossellini, because after all, she consented to do what she did on the screen, number one. Number two, I'm sure she's walking around wherever she lives, New York City or whatever, and survived the whole experience, just like Janet Leigh survived the shower scene in Psycho. So I don't think that that's pertinent. I think what's exciting about the film, and it is challenging, is it starts out with flowers and sunlight, and it's a happy little town, and then we dig deeper and we find out it's a nasty town, or at least a couple of people are nasty. And I sat there, and this did for me, and I use the Psycho example again, this did for me what Psycho did as a lot younger, which is eyes open and, oh my God, we're really getting in over our heads. And that's an experience which is challenging, shocking, but mesmerizing, and I like the picture.
Hi everyone, and welcome to the podcast Under the Stairs. This is a brand new episode of the show where we're kicking off a full new series, a new subset of shows called In Reverence. I'm your host, Duncan McLeish. Welcome to the show. So this subset of shows came to me as an idea when I was in a supermarket, and I walked past a Blu-ray copy of Blue Velvet, and I thought to myself, why do I not own Blue Velvet? Blue Velvet is legitimately one of my favourite films ever made, yet I do not own it on Blu-ray, which is just weird, I had it on DVD, but I recently sold all my DVDs because I'm refusing to buy in that medium now, purely buying in Blu-ray. Purely buying in sweet, 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 gorgeous Blu-ray. So, yeah, I purchased it and then I thought, you know, this is an interesting talking point. I have so many films which I consider as being some of the great titles in the genre that never get discussed about on the podcast Under the Stairs, and it's not because I don't want to talk about them, it's not because my guests don't want to talk about them. I think that sometimes titles are too obvious, or maybe sometimes it's a case that it's difficult to plan a show around these titles. So let's just review them. Let's just review them as standalone movies under the tag In Reverence, because that is how I feel about these movies. So over the next year and beyond, probably, most likely, my favourite films, the movies that I genuinely all think are five-star movies, we're going to cover in a shorter format, but kind of more focused at what they mean to me, what I take away from the movies, and just a discussion about their direction, the acting, all the stuff that you would usually get from a podcast Under the Stairs episode. So I'm very excited to be doing this, kicking off this very first one with, like I said, one of the great cinematic experiences, which is David Lynch's Blue Velvet. So we're going to get into that in a minute, but as always, some house notes right up at the start here, some for housekeeping purposes, ladies and gents. I just want to thank everyone who bought a t-shirt on this recent campaign. We well exceeded the target that we had set for ourselves, to be honest, that the website sets for ourselves, and that is, so huge. I am completely humbled. Every time I think about how much participation you guys do in terms of supporting this show, it's incredible. And I can't thank you all enough for it. So thank you very much for everyone that did that out there. Also, just a quick update. The Baz V Giallo show will be recording real soon. So that will be coming out very, very soon. So keep your eyes peeled for that one. For more details, the return of the Baz, his last stop before we tackle the Texas Chainsaw Massacre franchise. And if you've been following everything that has been posted on the page over the last week, you will also know that we announced a very special quarterly edition of Baz V Horror, where Baz is going to take on some of the greats in genre cinema. We're calling it Baz V The Masters of Horror, and every 3 to 4 months, the Baz will sit down with a collection of films, either 2 or 3 films, from a director that I have deemed a master of horror. We announced that on our Facebook group page via live streaming. Now, it does occur to me that not everyone that listens to this show follow us on Facebook. We do quite a lot of live streaming content now. We do one every Thursday night called Thirsty Thursdays, where we sit down and we answer questions from the listeners live in real time, and we just interact and have fun. But we also like to make announcements over there of when things are going to happen, what's planned, etc. And the only way you can check that out is being a member of our Facebook group page, which is facebook.com/groups/tputzcast, to get all that sweet juicy information over there. So please, please, please do that. Join over there, interact with us. We have, for whatever reason, in the last week or so, been bombarded with a shitload of fake accounts. I don't know why. I'm fairly ruthless about that. Me and Baz have spoken about this before. If it looks like you have next to no online presence, if it looks like you have absolutely no interest in horror, and it looks like you don't follow any other horror podcast, there is a very good chance that we will block you. Just because it looks like you are a fake account. And like I say, over the last week, I think there's been about 10 or 15, somewhere in that region, of fake accounts coming across and trying to add them to the page. Which is a shame, because I get excited every time it says new member request, and then you jump in, you do a bit of research, and it doesn't look good at all. So a couple of talking points to keep your eyes peeled for. Next week's episode will be a ton of fun as well. Myself and Bo Ransdale are going to be looking at what some people would argue is the best horror movie of the year thus far, and the worst horror movie of this year thus far. So next Monday's episode we'll be looking at Get Out, the directorial debut of Jordan Peele into the horror genre, and a little movie called The Bye Bye Man, which is rancid. So yeah, that should be a fun discussion point. I think that's all I wanted to get off my chest at the start of this episode. This one will not run long, ladies and gents. The idea behind In Reverence is to really just get stuck in to the meat and bones of a movie title that I genuinely think is one of the greats. So without any further ado, I'm going to take my first break of this episode. You know, promos for shows that I love. You're going to hear the trailer for the movie we're going to be discussing on this very first In Reverence episode. We're looking at one of the greats. It's David Lynch's Blue Velvet. I'll be right back to discuss that movie right after this.
In a world gone mad.
As you know, the Doomsday Clock is a symbolic clock face analogizing humankind's proximity to extinction.
One man must fight to survive on the global junk heap of the future.
You maniacs! You blew it up! Damn you! God damn you all to hell!
Which versus the Doomsday Clock is that man's story. His search for entertainment is transmitted across time and space for your listening pleasure on iTunes, Stitcher, Podbean, and your Android device. This podcast is not fit for human consumption. Side effects include laughter, concern, nausea, vomiting, and blame for more purposes. The producers accept no responsibility for any side effects, illness, or internet ranking mine cause. My bank guarantee is worth nothing. Zero, zilch, zilch, nada, overall, not a sausage. In short, you get nothing. Nothing. Good day, sir.
Beneath the surface of the perfect small town, a dark world awaits.
Are you the one that found the ear?
You know anything?
Well, one name that keeps coming up is this woman's singer.
I'll bet someone could learn a lot by getting into that woman's apartment.
I don't know if you're a detective or a pervert.
Well, it's for me to know and you to find out.
What are you doing in my apartment?
I close my eyes.
Are you a bad boy?
Hey!
Who is this?
You're like me.
Don't be a good neighbor to her.
And welcome back. So you've just heard the trailer for this feature movie review of this brand new In Reverence series. This is Blue Velvet, written and directed by David Lynch from 1986. The movie stars Isabella Rossellini, Kyle MacLachlan, Dennis Hopper, Laura Dern, Hope Lang, Dean Stockwell, George Dickerson, Priscilla Pointer, Francis Bay, Jack Harvey, Brad Dourif, Jack Nance, and there are other people in the movie. The synopsis is listed on IMDb. The discovery of a severed human ear found in the fields leads a young man on an investigation related to a beautiful, mysterious nightclub singer and a group of psychopathic criminals who have kidnapped her child. So what we'll do in these reviews is we will start off by kind of going through the plot synopsis. So as always, this is just a gentle reminder that if you've never seen the movie Blue Velvet, please, please, please go away and watch the movie before listening to this episode. We are going to go right through the entire plot synopsis, giving away spoilers, etc., and then in the discussion, so, and my theories as well, which may taint your viewing if you've never seen the movie before. It might taint your viewing if you watch the movie back, so you may want to watch it before listening to this episode. So, what happens in the movie Blue Velvet? Well, essentially, the whole movie is set in this kind of small logging town called Lumberton in North Carolina, and the movie opens with this kind of beautiful shot of white picket fences and, you know, this idea of suburbia, which David Lynch has really become synonymous with, is this great idea of the American dream juxtaposed right beside everything that lies beneath the surface, which is darker and more malevolent. And there's a really interesting shot where we open of seeing all these white picket fences and these beautiful roses and these tulips, and as the camera pans down and we get underneath the grass, we start to see that there's all these rather nasty creepy crawlies, these bugs, and there's something darker which lies beneath the surface. However, without going into all the symbolism in this movie, of which we could spend like an entire 3-hour episode going through, because it is David Lynch after all, we open with Kyle MacLachlan's father having a kind of a near fatal stroke whilst doing the gardening, and he's taken to hospital. And Jeffrey Beaumont, played by Kyle MacLachlan, is visiting his father in the hospital, trying to make sure that he's okay. He's returned back to make sure his dad's okay. He's been away studying. And as he's walking back through some kind of derelict grassland from the hospital, which leads back to his house, his attention is somehow drawn to a patch of grass. And when he looks in very close, he finds a severed human ear, which is quite startling to say the least. Takes it to the police station, where he's met by John Williams, who's played by George Dickerson. George Dickerson's character as a detective is very... I love David Lynch's portrayal of certain characters. There does not appear to be any shock in his face where he sees this ear. He's just, yep, this looks like a human ear. As if it's just normal, run-of-the-mill, mundane police stuff. So essentially, from this kind of... this event, this coming together of these characters, Jeffrey bumps into Sandy, who is played by Laura Dern, kind of earlier role for Laura Dern. She is the daughter of Detective Williams, and they start conversing, and she tells him that she's kind of overheard discussions about a case involving a Dorothy Valance, played by Isabella Rossellini. Now, Rossellini is quite an interesting character here, is that she's not really an actress. She wasn't really known as being an actress. She's very much a model up into this kind of time frame. She's famed for being the daughter of the Swedish actress Inga Bergman and the Italian neorealist Robert Rossellini. And not long after the collaboration in this movie, she became romantically linked to David Lynch. And to be fair, in this movie, she's put through the ringer. Her character is quite heavily abused. But the investigation kicks off with much gusto, with Sandy and Jeffrey playing amateur detectives by trying to get to the bottom of Dorothy's involvement in this severed ear case. Now, Jeffrey's dad happens to own the local DIY store, and whilst he's in there, like, helping out and reacquainting with the staff that work in this store, he comes across kit that would allow him to pose as an exterminator. So they hatch this plan, Jeffrey and Dorothy do, that what they're going to do, Jeffrey and Sandy do, what they're going to do is essentially they are going to pose as an exterminator to gain access to her house, her apartment, and then what they'll do afterwards is find a way to leave a window open that'll give them access later on when she's out singing at a local club, which she does. Jeffrey manages to gain access to the property, and while he is fake spraying down the room, the plan slightly goes off the rails when a man dressed in a yellow suit arrives at the door. He is later referred to by Jeffrey as the Yellow Man. While she is distracted, Dorothy that is, Jeffrey steals a spare key which is hanging up in the kitchen to give him access later on. Jeffrey and Sandy's investigation then kind of takes to this kind of idea of the private investigator, the kind of stalk thing, where they go to a local nightclub where Rossellini's character sings at. She sings Blue Velvet, which is, guess what, the name of the movie. And whilst they leave early to sneak off into the apartment, they come up with this plan that what they will do is that Jeffrey will go into the apartment, look for clues. Sandy will honk the horn a few times to let Jeffrey know when Dorothy has returned, so that way she can alert him and he can get out without being caught. Things don't go exactly according to plan, however, as Jeffrey is in the toilet flushing the toilet, making enough noise which drowns out the horn which indicates that Dorothy has returned. He panics and hides in her closet and then peeps through as she has a rather disturbing phone call conversation with someone called Frank, and then begins to undress. He makes a noise which unfortunately alerts Dorothy, who then, with knife in hand, discovers him and threatens to kill him. She thinks that he may be some sort of peeping Tom, and nothing to do with the case that he's actually investigating, so she forces him to undress, and at knife point, begins to give him oral sex, and then the door knocks. So he hides back in the cupboard, and then we get our first viewing of Frank Booth, played by Dennis Hopper. Now, Frank Booth as a character is one of the most disturbing, malevolent creations ever on the screen, and I think Dennis Hopper in this movie really takes things to a bizarre level that even Lynch, I think, has struggled to gain from other actors. It's quite funny, Dennis Hopper being a notorious drug fiend, womanizer, etc. in Hollywood, pretty much said that he needed to play Frank Booth because he was Frank Booth. He could completely relate to where this character was coming from. So Frank comes in, is incredibly disrespectful and violent towards Dorothy's character. He also seems to have this proclivity to huff down amyl nitrate through this gas mask that he keeps, and when he does this, his mania increases to levels which are truly fantastic on the screen. He forces Rosalie's character to sit in a chair and spread her legs and show her vagina. I know we're getting a wee bit graphic here, to which he then repeats the line, baby wants to fuck, which is kind of, it's disturbing to say the least, and nowhere near arousing at all. I've said that way, so it kind of sounds like it is. It's just a very intense, weird scene. Frank is the only character really in this movie that curses, that swears. He uses the word fuck pretty much in every single sentence. He also has an even more menacing way of how he refers to Rosalini. She is mummy, he is daddy, until he huffs down the gas and then he becomes baby. And it is very, very, very strange. It's one of those surreal scenes that I think just stands out in cinema as just something on a completely different level to anything else. It's so surrealist that it is very uncomfortable to watch, but at the same time, you can't peel your eyes off the screen. Frank has kidnapped Dorothy's husband and her small child, and is basically forcing her to degrade herself and perform sexual acts on him. Now, he is the one that we're led to believe that has cut the ear off her husband, and for some reason it ended up out in the grass. We're not entirely sure why, but he's done this as a way to basically strong arm her into doing exactly what he wants. When he leaves, Dorothy essentially consoles herself with Jeffrey, and like they almost make love, but we find that Dorothy kind of likes the idea of being physically harmed in order to get off, and Jeffrey is at this stage too much of a nice guy to do it, so he refuses to hurt her and then leaves. Jeffrey then meets back up with Sandy and they basically begin their investigation into Frank. Sandy tells at this stage about this wonderful dream she had about robins, and that she interprets them as a sign of hope for humanity. Now this will become important at the end. Jeffrey and Sandy are clearly attracted to each other, but Sandy already has a boyfriend who goes to school with her. He's on the football team. So it is unlikely at this stage that anything is going to happen between them. And as such, Jeffrey begins to frequent the apartment of Dorothy. As he does that, they start to fall for each other, and Jeffrey starts to get a taste for the darker side of life. Dorothy consistently performs Blue Velvet at the club, different versions of it. When Jeffrey goes to see Dorothy perform at the club the next time, she's not playing with the full band, she's playing just with the piano, and she spots that Frank is in the crowd. He's fondling a piece of blue velvet fabric which has come from Dorothy's robe. This will also come into play later on. Jeffrey follows Frank. He begins to do the old private investigator, I'm going to stake this guy out, do a little bit of spying on him. And he basically follows them and a well-dressed man and a yellow man exit an industrial building that Frank frequently visits. Jeffrey concludes that the men are criminal associates of Frank and he goes off to basically update Sandy as to what has been happening. At this point, it looks like things start to move in a romantic way for both Laura Dern's character and Kyle MacLachlan, but you know, she's still seeing someone, so that can't happen yet. So Jeffrey then goes to see Dorothy, and yeah, they have sex, quite intense, passionate sex, during which, in an argument and a heated exchange of words, MacLachlan raises his hands and slaps Rossellini in the face. She is instantly attracted to this action. It becomes even more emotional and even more intense, and you can see in Jeffrey's face how confused and horrified he is that Dorothy is getting so much pleasure from being hurt. After they have sex, they're getting ready to leave the apartment, and Frank arrives with his gang and catches both Dorothy and Jeffrey in the hallway. And through a rather intense exchange of words, Jeffrey gets accosted by the group and put in the car to go for a drive. And they go to visit Ben, who is a very close friend of Frank. Now, Ben's played by Dean Stockwell, and he is, to say the least, one of the more jarring characters in this movie. He is quite effeminate. He appears to wear makeup. He's also quite a violent person as well. At one point he punches Jeffrey in the stomach after he's been held up, and he is the one that is holding Dorothy's son captive. We get a fantastic scene where Ben starts to lip sync In Dreams by Roy Orbison, which appears to be a song that connects both Frank and Ben together. Frank then takes Jeffrey to a lumberyard, and when he is molesting Dorothy, he tries to rape her in the car. Jeffrey stands up by punching Frank in the face. Frank's rage takes over. He gets them to his henchmen to take Jeffrey out the car and hold him as he begins to, in a very bizarre scene, apply makeup to his face and then kiss with the lipstick all over Jeffrey's face before he then beats him down horribly, whilst In Dreams plays in the background. In the morning, Jeffrey wakes up a kind of beaten man in the ground, and he makes his way back home and then goes to the police station to report what he's seen. And when he's in the police station, he finds out that the man in yellow is actually a police officer. And at this point, he can't make any report to there in fear of being discovered, his actions being discovered, that he has in fact been spying on Frank's character. Later, he goes to Sandy's home and he confesses what they've been doing to Sandy's father, John Williams, the police detective, and lets him know the full story, but does it out of earshot of Sandy because he doesn't want her to know everything. Jeffrey and Sandy then go to a dance together, and at this point their relationship starts to blossom, and they are driving home from what has been a great night, and Sandy's boyfriend tries to run them off the road. So they pull their car over and they're about to throw down, I believe is what the kids call it, when they find Dorothy, who is naked and heavily beaten up, distressed on Jeffrey's front lawn. It is then a case of protecting her, so they take Dorothy to Sandy's parents' house, and as they're consoling her, it begins to become apparent that Jeffrey has done more than just investigate Dorothy's life. Sandy becomes very acutely aware that they've been sleeping together. She becomes very upset. She slaps Jeffrey in the face. Jeffrey insists on going back to Dorothy's apartment. This is his next level of investigation. He thinks that if he can go there, then everything will be fine. He'll be able to get the final clues to save not only Dorothy's husband, but her kid. And In the meantime, John Williams, Sandy's dad, is going to begin an investigation into Frank's gang and the man in yellow. Jeffrey arrives at the apartment, and this is a fucking wonderful scene. When he walks into the apartment, he finds Dorothy's husband is dead. He died from a gunshot to the head. But not only is he there, he has that bit of blue velvet we saw earlier on crammed into his mouth. We know it's definitely Dorothy's husband because his ear is missing. But also at the same time, the man in yellow is standing in an almost zombie-like kind of state. He's been shot in the head and we can see part of his brain hanging out. But he's not fully dead yet. He's almost kind of a catatonic zombie-like stance. He's about to leave when the radio in the man in yellow's pocket goes off and he hears that the police are doing a raid. They're raiding the kind of industrial area which Jeffrey had been at earlier, and there's a gunfight in play. We then jump back and Jeffrey has the police radio. He's going to contact Sandy's dad to give him an update. And during his update of letting him know that he's in the apartment, he realises that there's a very good chance that Frank is the one that has... Well, Frank is the well-dressed man in disguise, but also that there's a very good chance that he has a police radio. So he lies about his location. He says that he's inside Dorothy's bedroom and meanwhile makes her run for the closet that he was in earlier on. Frank comes in manic and begins to search the apartment, shooting around the area, trying to find Jeffrey. He comes out the room, he kills a man in yellow, right in the head, puts him down because he obviously knows that he is already kind of dead. But as Frank's firing around and confused, we already see that Jeffrey has acquired the man in yellow's gun. He sits in the closet, the last place that Frank is going to check. When Frank opens the door, Jeffrey shoots him in the head and puts him down. Detective Williams arrives with Sandy moments later to find that Jeffrey is okay. And this kind of closes the case. The last scene in this movie is this kind of almost dreamlike scene where everything is fine and the sun is out and both Sandy and Jeffrey are happy together and his dad's back up and he's doing well and the families are kind of coming together. And we also see this scene of a robin sitting on the windowsill eating a bug. We get a kind of really nice montage sequence of life coming back to normal in suburbia. And a scene of Dorothy and her son reunited. And that's how the movie closes out. So why do I love this movie? Why is this one the first title that we're going to discuss on In Reverence? Well, a couple of reasons. One, I think this is the movie that really sets David Lynch on the path that he has been on since as a filmmaker. It's no stretch of the imagination. There are many articles written about this subject. This is the precursor to Twin Peaks, which is one of my favourite TV shows of all time. A lot of the ideas in Twin Peaks exist in a kind of proto fashion within Blue Velvet. Blue Velvet was an idea that Lynch had been kicking around for many years, from the time that he was at university studying. He'd already got an original draft of what he thought he was going to do with Blue Velvet, which basically all come out of the fact that he was fascinated by the Tony Bennett song Blue Velvet from 1951. He said that when he listened to it, he, even though it's not his sort of music, he found himself kind of pasting this idea and building layers of a mystery about what could be Blue Velvet and what was there. And then from that, he had this idea of, wouldn't it be cool to do a kind of noirish movie which peeled back these layers of this kind of idyllic life to, or the American dream, so to speak, to what happens behind closed doors or the other side of the street, the other side of town. He had a very striking image of someone finding a severed ear outside, and he also had this idea of this peeping Tom, and he started to piece it together, but it took ages for him, like many years. And this movie went through several drafts and almost never happened had it not been for the fact that his version of Dune was a commercial and critical failure. It almost destroyed Lynch's career, and he was riding high before that. He'd done The Elephant Man, which was very well received, and he'd done Eraserhead, which, even though is very much acknowledged as a cult movie, had done very well with critics. So Blue Velvet was a gamble for him to try something different, and De Laurentiis, who was a production company behind backing quite a lot of the Lynchian projects at the time, had kind of made a gamble on, this is what I want you to do, this is going to be your next project. And Lynch had to fine-tune a second half of a movie which he was not happy with at all to try and get it in a capacity that he really liked. Lynch's vision for the movie was particularly single-minded. He did not want any meddling at all from studios. I think he'd had a bit of a bad time on Dune with the involvement there. I'm not being able to get his final realisation onto the screen, and as such took a salary cut to make the movie as long as he could have final cut. The film's original budget was about $10 million. He lowered the budget down to $6 million in order to make sure that his cut of the movie would be the one that people would see cinematically. There's a great series of little tidbits of information to do with this movie. One of my favourite things is that exactly the middle point of this movie, Jeffrey's character says, "I'm in the middle of a mystery," which, you know, happens at the 1 hour mark of the movie, and the movie is exactly 2 hours long. And it's that kind of Lynch sense of humour which just kind of permeates into to the movie in a way which, you know, it's kind of, once you know it, it becomes one of those things you smile upon repeat watching. And like I said earlier on, it's very difficult not to watch Blue Velvet and see this kind of almost architect's blueprint of movies like Lost Highway and certainly Mulholland Drive, as he's starting to experiment with the ideas of this kind of American suburbia. I mean, the opening shot is all beautiful. Like I said earlier on, we see all these white picket fences, this idyllic little village town that you want to live in, where everyone knows each other and everyone cares for each other. But as the camera zooms in, we start to see the nastiness underneath the surface, the bugs, the creepy crawlies that exist underneath the grass. And that pretty much sums up the entire movie, really. The more we find out about Lumberton, as Lumberton is really a town of two halves. One side is all the white picket fences, and everyone dresses in kind of pastel colours, whites, and everyone is very happy. And on the other side of the town, we have this darker, seedier side. This is where Rossellini lives. Everyone dresses in blacks and dark blues. We have this juxtaposition of this diner, as well as being an area where people congregate on the nice side of town, and the kind of slow club on the other side, which is this kind of dark, neon, dingy club where people that dress in dark colours sit to drink. And it's this idea of light and dark, yin and yang, that these kind of opposites that are played out in the movie. And that also represents a lot of Jeffrey's character. Jeffrey's character, albeit, lives on the light side of town, but for all intents and purposes is really a kind of proto-Frank character. And I mean, we even have the line later on in the movie where Frank looks over the car seat and looks at Jeffrey and says, "You're like me." And we can see that decline of the character. The first time we meet him, he's very cheery, he's kind of quizzical, but the more time he spends with Rossellini's character over that side, his demeanour changes, his colour of clothes all become black, which is once again this kind of symbolised version of evil, of the change in the character. He raises his hands to Rossellini, slapping her in the face, very similar to how Frank did it earlier on. And it's kind of Sandy's job to ground him, which is why that line about the robin and the dream is so important, because that final shot of the robin eating the bug is this idea of good triumphing over evil. If you remember the bugs we saw right at the very beginning scene lay beneath the surface, they are the malevolence, the darker side of things, and the Robin being seen as this kind of symbol of hope. The Robin eating the bug shows the triumphance of the kind of good over evil right at the very end. And even when we see McLaughlin's character right at the very end, he is wearing, it's like a white shirt, it's, you know, all the light colours again, because his character has found redemption by killing Frank. This movie is chock full of iconic imagery and iconic scenes. The scene of the ear. I remember the first time I saw this movie, and I would have been in my early teens, and just being wholly startled by, I mean, the front cover of Blue Velvet is McLaughlin and Rossellini in a kind of lover's embrace, and the title is written in such a script that you would think kind of romantic movie. So when you watch this movie and you get this kind of surreal state of, within the first 5 minutes, finding an ear, a severed ear with bugs crawling over it, it's decomposing and it's in a field, that's a shock to the system. You don't expect that. And the further we delve into the mystery, the kind of, in the best ways of kind of noirish cinema, the further we get in, the darker things go. I'm a big fan of noir cinema, and I mean, before I saw Blue Velvet, I'd already seen things like Chinatown, which at a very young age did not mean much to me, but I knew it was an aesthetic that I really enjoyed. So I think that's the, that's one of the really cool elements of what Lynch does here, is his take on noir cinema, and it works really well, and it carries through. He's obviously got a love for that style of cinema, because you could certainly say that there are elements of Lost Highway that are noirish, and certainly Mulholland Drive owes a lot to kind of 50s noir cinema. So he covers it here. Everything's off kilter. It has a weird kind of dreamlike sensibility about it, very similar to what he does in Twin Peaks. It lies somewhere between dream and nightmare, and I think that heightens the experience. I mean, Frank is the character of nightmares, or that scene of Ben singing the Roy Orbison song in Dreams, but he's not even singing it, he's miming it over a bulb which is handheld, which lights up his very pale, powder-paled face. It's just iconic scenes of cinema. I think what I love about the movie the most is the deliberate pace of the movie. This is a very slowed-down mystery. The pacing is put forward in such a way that your eyes drink in what you see. And there's a lot of symbolism in this movie. It's David Lynch, after all. Whether it's his use of electricity as being the precursor to something bad happening, whether it's fire, which he uses in a lot of his movies as an escalation point, the choice of music score in this movie is incredible. It's somewhere between the kind of symphonic orchestral work to these kind of classic songs of an era of which this movie is not set, which I think also works wonderful in here. I think the casting's brilliant as well. When we see Dennis Hopper really turn in a performance which kind of made him relevant again. By this point, he wasn't really doing much of the larger scale cinema. He'd been relegated to doing things like Texas Chainsaw 2, which is not a slight against Texas Chainsaw 2, but that's kind of where he had been leveled. He'd become not a pariah, but very much known for his addictions in Hollywood, and his return to here put him back on the map. Kyle MacLachlan is wonderful to watch. It's innocence, he's quizzical, and we get that through his expressions and his face, and it works wonderful. We can see why he later appears as a central character in Twin Peaks for very similar reasons, even though it's more in a kind of authoritarian position. Rossellini's fantastic in this movie. She really does get degraded as a character, but it is wonderful to see someone that went on and did performances afterwards as an actress, but I think this is possibly her finest role. Dern is fantastic as Sandy in this movie. She kind of, she is apple pie on the TV screen. She's the embodiment of everything that is pure and wholesome about America, and I think that works wonderful. And yeah, I think it's an incredible movie. I genuinely think the beauty of a David Lynch movie is that what you put into it is what you get back, and there are hours and hours of theories and articles and interpretations. Is it Freudian, for example? Could this be a Freudian thing? Where you look at the ideas of characters calling themselves baby and father and mother, and you know, all these ideas that kick around. That, you know, is Frank the kind of corruption of what essentially Jeffrey's character could become? Is this where he's going, but he has managed to pull away? Is that his life's trajectory, is to end up as Frank if he continues down the road that he's doing? I think all those ideas are wonderful, and I think they don't force you in this movie to think like that either. If you decide to take this movie completely superficial, then you will get just as much out of it as you would if you were sitting down analysing every scene. And the repeat viewing is what really makes the movie work for me. I think the more you watch it, the more you get out of it. So, yeah. I think, and I could go into loads of detail, and I really want to try and keep these episodes nice and concise. So, I genuinely think it is one of the highlights for me. Is it Lynch's best movie? Well, ladies and gents, Lynch will appear in reverence somewhere down the line, and we'll maybe start to flesh that out. I think it's the one for me that really puts him on the map, and that's nothing to take away from Eraserhead, which I think is a truly amazing film, or The Elephant Man, which is wonderfully powerful. Even now, is one of the very few movies that I've watched that I can feel the hairs on the back of my neck kind of stand up while watching it. But to me, Blue Velvet's the one that puts Lynch on the map, and essentially stakes his claim for the rest of his career. It's why Twin Peaks kind of consumed a generation. It's why things like Mulholland Drive are movies, or even to an extent Lost Highway, are movies that people will continually discuss and analyse for years and years to come. It's why I can't wait for Twin Peaks to return in just over a month's time for a new season. I can't wait to see what Lynch does next, and it's all here in Blue Velvet. So yeah, that's our first movie review on In Reverence, is Blue Velvet. A bit scattershot, too much to talk about in such a short time frame. I hope you go away and check it out. It is very much worth a watch if you've never seen it before. And if you've not seen it in a while, please check it out. The Blu-ray version I saw, the print is phenomenal. The movie never looked better. So yeah, go and check that one out. So I'm going to take my last break of the show. When I return, I'm closing it out right after this.
You're listening to the podcast Under the Stairs.
And you've been listening to the podcast Under the Stairs. This has been our first In Reverence episode, where we looked at David Lynch's 1986 movie, Blue Velvet. I love this movie so much. So, so good. And I can't wait to get more into this subset of shows, where we're going to take movies that I genuinely think are the ones that crafted my love of genre cinema, and delve a bit deeper, discuss them a bit more, where possible. Some of them are just going to be superficial reviews because there's just nothing beneath the surface. And the beauty of this series is that it will give you insight into the movies that I love and why I love them and what has shaped me. I think what might be cool as well is we may get a bit more interactive with these as we move on, and get you guys to start submitting in, whether it's by email or short audio clips to include in the show, to pick a movie that shaped your love of cinema and why, and incorporate them in here. So we can start really good discussion points on the Facebook group page as to the importance of seeing movies at certain ages and how they change our love, shape and mould our love of cinema moving forward. So yeah, this has been a ton of fun. I just want to thank everyone who's been giving support to the show over the last week. There's been tons going on. Checking out the live videos, commenting on that is always good fun from my point of view. And there was no drunk live videos this week, which is good, because I didn't do a lot of drinking. That was self disciplined to stop doing that. So yeah, thanks for checking those out, supporting us, checking out the shows, downloading them. As always, there's a multitude of ways that you can check out the podcast Under the Stairs. If you check us out on iTunes, please subscribe to the feed. That way you never miss any episodes as and when they drop. Plus you get access to the entire back catalogue of our episodes over there. And if you are subscribing, please leave us some feedback. It means the world to us. It's free for you to do. It only takes a couple of seconds. And the more of them we get, especially if it's 5 stars, the higher up the iTunes charts we're pushed for more people to check out the show, come across, and become part of our fantastic horror community. You can check us out on Stitcher, Smart Radio. You can check us out on SoundCloud. Please visit our website, tputzcast.com, and come across and become part of our fantastic Facebook community. facebook.com/groups/teapotscast. We do all manner of weird and wonderful things over there, great discussion points and live stream videos, so do not delay, come across today. We also have a twin prong of social media sexiness, and they're both admin by the very sexy Baz. You can check us out on Instagram and on Twitter at teapotscast for both of them. Right, I wanted to keep this episode under an hour. It looks like I've kept this episode under an hour, so that is a job well done, Duncan. We'll be doing more of these in reverence episodes as and when the opportunity arises. We'll try and do one every other month, and try and keep the format the same and the timing the same within an hour. Nice, easy listen to kick your week off. But until the next time I speak to you, ladies and gents, please take care of yourselves wherever you are in the world, whatever you're up to, and whatever the time zone is. This is Duncan McLeish broadcasting live from Under the Stairs, signing off. She the night. So